Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
This podcast is a Roifield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
In an uncertain world, there is always music which can be listened to in good company. Welcome to Friday, the show where we speak to friends and interesting people to the backdrop of great music. Today we speak to Jez Collins from the Birmingham Music Archive to ask, if Birmingham is so big, just why isn't it better? Largest city in the United Kingdom. Its GDP is the biggest outside of London. Its six universities make it the largest centre of higher education outside of the capital. It has major cultural institutions. It's given the world heavy metal and Bhangra, just to name two forms of music which have bestrided the world. Why is it that we're still second to Manchester culturally? What is it about us Brummies that we are seen as the butt of many a joke?
Wow, what an opening question. It depends on how you see it and think about it. I mean, you know, are we second to Manchester? Are Manchester second to us? Do we want to be second to anyone? You know, these are sort of questions that, you know, interest me. Manchester is a fantastic city, as is Liverpool, as is Bristol, Sheffield, Glasgow.
Sheffield not so much.
Oh, I love Sheffield. I think Sheffield's a great city, and you know, it's industrial heritage, it's music heritage, you know, it's really important, it's film and playwrights, you know, and in association with Leeds as well. So I do think Yorkshire, Sheffield and Leeds are also great cities, but Birmingham, as you say, on any sort of metric that you want to use, whether it's population, geographic spread or size, the local authority, GDP. I've just read some work last week that, you know, tourism into the city was 7.1 billion last year. We have the highest hotel occupancy outside of London. So in any sort of measure, it's a major city. It's a major global city, European and global city. And, you know, I'm going to be slightly contradictory here and say, that really, I don't see us being in competition with Manchester. I think we coexist, and we should appreciate and respect and talk about.
Yes, yep. I don't think that we're in competition with Manchester either, right? But if you were to ask the average Brit on the street, second city of the United Kingdom, I'm not going to say it'll be 50-50 that would say Birmingham and Manchester, but a lot would say Manchester. And there is something about Manchester that culturally, in terms of the popular cultural weight of that city, it's dwarfed Birmingham. Maybe it's because of geography, it's further enough away from London. In a way Manchester is the capital of the north, in a way that Birmingham isn't quite the capital of the Midland.
I think you're absolutely right. I think there's three things that you can think about when, you know, if you're looking at that question, if you ask people on the street. One, I think absolutely is that geographic distance from London. It sounds daft, but, you know, Birmingham is 120 miles, an hour and a half in the train, 2 hours by car. That's quite a, you know, small journey. That extra 100 miles up to Manchester adds another hour and a half on. It makes it difficult to get back there and back in the day, you know, if you're doing business. And so, from my understanding, Manchester has developed and kept a lot of its infrastructures. I mean, it's a great city in terms of the industrial heritage and of the town, of the city. But there is that sense that they have created and kept those infrastructures, particularly with music, which I know we're going to talk about a lot. I think, secondly, there is this north-south. So I think there is a sense that, you know, Manchester, the country is divided into north and south. So Manchester is the north, London is the south, and Birmingham is somewhere in the middle. And so you get that sort of separation of people distinguished in England between the north and the south. And so they automatically think of Manchester. And then I think the third thing, and I think you can't overlook this, I think the football teams, particularly Manchester United, play a huge role in the perception of Manchester. And if you put that alongside people like Tony Wilson, but also people like David Lees, I think his name was, and I forget the other guys, Graham Stringer, who were in charge of the city in the 80s through the 90s, as that post-industrial and post the IRA bomb. I think those sorts of those three elements have come together to give Manchester a much higher profile in terms of both in the UK and perhaps globally. And you cannot underestimate the importance of Manchester football in that, you know, both Man City and Man United, but particularly Manchester United. And you can't, and with, you know, Birmingham sort of is fighting against that. What I think we could do better, and I think what we haven't done is in the civic leadership of the city. And I think we've had some fantastic politicians, and I think Albert Bohr, whether you love or loathe him, you know, did a lot for Birmingham in the late 80s.
Who? So, because that's the thing about the Manchester politicians. Mm. They've managed to transcend Manchester, Greater Manchester, and whether they're large or small players, they're still players. Mm. They're still names which have some kind of national repute. Mm. Now, question for you: which did more destruction to Birmingham? Was it the Distribution of Industry Act of 1945, or was it the Luftwaffe?
I think the Distribution Act in 1948, and then the Labour government in 1964. Birmingham was growing exponentially during those periods, post-war periods. I think there was unemployment between 1948 and 1966 was between 1% and 2%, very rarely got to 2%. Employment was booming. And so in 1948, the Distribution Act sort of was worried about the economic census in London, was trying to distribute across the country, but that massively affected Birmingham. And then the Labour government, the incoming Labour government in 64, put in acts that meant building work couldn't be constructed in the city centre. And that was a real, put a real slowdown in terms of the city. And we lost something in the region of, I think in those years, the population was 1.1 million and it shrank to 900,000. So we lost 200,000+ people from the city, and the city stagnated. And then, of course, in the 70s, we had that huge economic, manufacturing crash. Birmingham was built on manufacturing, you know, big manufacturing in terms of cars, but also light manufacturing, and that had a massive.
So you've got Wilson in 1964. It's the white heat of technology and all of that. What was their thinking? Because I'm sure they didn't just decide, right, we're going to strangle Birmingham. You know, what was their thinking? What was the genesis of the idea for them to say, right, we're going to say that you can't put too many buildings in the centre of Birmingham?
I think it was a strangulation. I think, you know, there's some academic work that I'm referencing by Sutcliffe and Smith. I'm just reading now, you know, declaring the growth in population and employment within Birmingham to be, in quotes, a threatening situation. The incoming Labour government of 1964 sought to, quote, control the growth of office accommodation in Birmingham and the rest of Birmingham conurbation before it got out of hand. So there was, you know, there was a concerted effort to stop the growth of Birmingham. And I don't think many people in the city sort of understand it. And I think we're still coming out of that period of the 64 government being worried about the growth threat. Now, I wouldn't say threatening London, but I think they looked at it about an unequal distribution in terms of the rest of the country, and they were trying to push things out so there's a more equal spread while, you know, keeping London as it was. And London now dominates, you know, way more than any other national city, I think, or capital in the world. It's very hard to think of another country so dominated by its capital. And that had a huge effect on Birmingham. And as I say, you know, as we went into the 70s, we lost 200,000 people and the skills and the knowledge that they had. And as we went into the 70s, the car manufacturing and steel manufacturing, foundry work coal all were diminished and soon became redundant, and that left a gaping hole in the city. And I don't think Manchester, you know, going back to Manchester, I don't think Manchester was so reliant on that type of manufacturing. And they changed their economic base, you know, earlier on. Although, you know, Manchester 1980 was a pretty tough industrial town. It was, you know, really, you know, on the outskirts. It was derelict almost, you know, like a lot of other sort of cities in the Midlands and the North. So there's a combination of these sorts of things that come up that have really, I think, have really held Birmingham back. And if you look at Birmingham's economic base now, it's more about the service sector. So we've gone more into finance, insurance, and I think, you know, that caused a problem in 2008. There was a lot of building work and relocation of banks and building societies and insurance centres were coming into Birmingham out of London because of the costs. And then the recession happened. So, you know, Birmingham's had a very checkered history of economic growth, but what it's always done, it's always bounced back, and it's a very resilient city. Some would argue that, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about this in a bit more detail, some would argue that the city council and its agencies have been a bit too gung-ho in terms of their our city motto is forward, and we are forever redeveloping, knocking down, redeveloping, rebuilding certainly the city centre core. Some people would argue that too quickly and too much. But, you know, we are a very resilient city, and this separation between the north and the south, I think we just tend to get on with things and do things. We have an amazing amazing crafts and innovation based from hundreds of years of making and creating, inventing things. And I think that's held us in good stead. And that's the story for me. That's where we should be telling our stories.
If you travel the world and you go to its cities of renown, whether it's, let's say, Sydney or Paris, San Francisco, New York, Milan, is that these cities are always beautiful. Mm. Renowned as being spectacular isn't one of the many things which has shackled our city, the fact that it's not seen as being that, is it? Mm. It's seen as being somewhat dowdy in terms of architecture. It's not inspiring. It's not majestic.
Mm, that's a good question. I mean, I think, that's a complex question. So, you know, we're landlocked, right? So we are nowhere near the sea, which is a great shame. We don't have a major river running through us, which is another great shame. I think the city would be massively different if the River Ray was, you know, like the Thames or the Seine. I think we do have outstanding natural beauty, you know, within minutes of the city. So you could work in the city, and in 10, you know, if I drive from my house, which is in the west of the city, for 10, 15 minutes, I'm up in the Clent Hills, which are outstanding natural hills. Another 20 minutes on, you got the Malvern Hills, and then the other side of the city, the Lick Hills. So we are surrounded by an incredible countryside. So there's that greenery. You'll know this, but we do have, so having said we have no rivers, you know, we did create, majorly create the canal network, and we are the centre of the canal network, which was used mainly for industry 100 years or so ago. But we have more miles of canal than Venice. I understand we have more trees and green space than any other city in Europe. So we have natural beauty rather than man-made beauty in the city. But we have to acknowledge that we have acted with great impunity and haste in knocking down our buildings as recently as like 1970. There is an argument, if you go back and you look, there is an argument to say that Birmingham would have been one of the great Victorian cities in terms of its architecture. But unfortunately, pre-war with Manzoni, they knocked some incredible buildings down, like the science school that was in town, the Victorian Victorian Library, and just the King Edward School, New Street Station, Moore Street Station. So we knocked down a lot of our incredible buildings, and that left, it did leave a rather brutal-looking building. But what I always say to people is that if you come to Birmingham, don't listen to those stories about its concrete brutality. Just raise your eyes above shop level as you're walking around, above street level, and much of that beauty still remains. Although we locked a lot of the buildings down, actually we redeveloped a lot of them at ground level for retail. And if you look up, particularly around the inner core, there is some incredible, beautiful buildings. So there is an absolute beautiful architecture in the city, but it's just not in your face. It's a bit like we've been saying before, isn't it, about, you know, what we, how we talk about the city and how we promote ourselves. You just gotta look a bit harder, and in this case you gotta look up a little bit, and I think if you do that, you'll be richly rewarded. Having said that, you know, it typical of Birmingham, you know, we built in the 60s and the 70s, you know, quite a lot of brutalist buildings, and decided to, and I'm talking really about John Maiden's work, who's one of the most important architects in the country. And at the point where brutalism is now on vogue and being recognised for its brilliance, and Maiden is being recognised, we are knocking down all these buildings. So at that point where brutalism is being recognised, Birmingham is knocking down all its incredible brutalist building. So I don't know what it is, something in the water about Birmingham. You know, our motto is forward, and I think we are where we definitely lead the world, I think, is in knocking down buildings and rebuilding them, and then knocking them down and then rebuilding them. But if you come to the city now, the city is starting to be opened up a bit like a flower, a bit like a petal. It's starting to open up and reveal itself. They're knocking down, you know, whether rightly or wrongly, places. But what they are doing is revealing new insights to the architecture. You're starting to stand its own, particularly around the town hall and the council, which for me is one of the great sort of European squares. It's absolutely beautiful. When you stand outside the council house at the top of New Street and you look at that, and you look at the town hall, you look at the Chamberlain Square, it is absolutely stunning. And so we aren't a Paris, we aren't a London, we aren't Milan. But there is a multitude of beauties and architectural styles in the city. You know, some of our pubs that remain. So again, it's one of those. It's just, you just have to dig and look a little bit deeper in Birmingham. And if you do, it will reward you. And
Jez,
yeah,
Jez, why didn't you run to be city mayor? Because I can't think of a more passionate professional Brummie than you. We've got who is the mayor of Birmingham now? Well, the new mayor.
That's very kind. So there's two things about mayors, right? There is a mayor of Birmingham, which is drawn from the local council group, and it tends to go to the eldest councillor, and it's an honorary position for a year. And then we have an elected mayor for the West Midlands Combined Authority. And I want to make these points as well, actually, Roy, because you've mentioned the words Greater Manchester. The mayor of the West Midlands Combined Authority is a guy called Andy Street, who is from Birmingham, or Solihull, and was the chief exec of Lewis's, and the department store that, you know, he oversaw rapid expansion. He's a Conservative MP. He beat Sean Simon, who was the Labour candidate. Two things, I'll come back on why I'm not a mayor. We struggle in this city and in our region, where Manchester have really pushed forward, is we have a continual squabble about what is or how to describe ourselves. So Coventry and Warwick and Solihull aren't part of our combined authority. They've gone it alone. Wolverhampton and Walsall are, but they can't agree on being called the Greater Birmingham Authority, like Manchester. So Manchester is made up of Manchester, Bury, Oldham, Eccles, Salford, Trafford, you know.
And Wigan's nowhere near and Manchester, and they're cool.
Yeah, exactly. But they understand that the capital of that region is Manchester, and that's what has the kudos attached to the name. So if you go to China, they understand that people probably won't know about Wigan, but they'll have heard of Manchester. It's exactly, for me, it's exactly the same in Birmingham. You know, if you go to China or wherever, India, you know, with all due respect, people aren't really going to know about Walsall, West Brom, Wolverhampton. They might have heard a little bit about them, but they certainly know about Birmingham. The trade is big, as you've already said, you know, GDP, trade, etc. It's a real issue for me that we aren't known as Greater Birmingham. I think that would give us a much stronger identity. And unfortunately, identity means a lot. And I understand those people and those authorities in Wolves and Walsall wanting to hold on to that identity. But
so, Jez, are you saying that basically the root of our problem is branding? So we're not in the north, we're not in the south, we're in the Midland, branding issue. Our most success, I'm a Birmingham City fan, but I will concede when I'm being honest, that Aston Villa have been a little bit more successful historically than Birmingham City. And so the most successful team is not even called Birmingham. In terms of understanding what we are in terms of a conurbation, little Walsall, silly Dudley, right, don't want to be called Greater Birmingham. So they shoot themselves and then us in the foot by not being called that. It's all about branding. And then we're saddled with this accent that is always seen as the least attractive when it comes to all these English accents. And then the last thing, we gave the whole world heavy metal.
Yeah, okay.
It's all about negative branding, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. To an extent, I wouldn't want to say it's all about branding, because I think there are, it's always much more complex than that, isn't it, Royfield? I think that, you know, people, you know, there are strong...
I don't know. Heavy metal, we've got a lot to apologise.
I'll come back onto that. Let's go back to Dudley and Wolverhampton just for a sec, because I think, you know, the Black Country is a very proud region. You know, it's got deep, deep links to this country and its history. And I think I understand their desire to hold on to their identity, but I do agree with you that it does them no favours, I think, in terms of a capitalist market. And it's what we're talking about, you know, capitalism, really, I suppose, in terms of being holding on to that identity or refusing to be part of a broader set of activities under the Greater Birmingham umbrella. I think there'd be much more, the perception, and that is branding, the perceptions and the branding would help them and would help Birmingham, I think. But I do understand it's more complex than that. Heavy metal, I wouldn't apologise for. I think heavy metal, you know, it couldn't have been made anywhere else. And I think, you know, and again, this is more complex, but I think people like Tony Iommi and Ozzy Osbourne, Bill Ward, and Geezer Butler, Judas Priest guys, John Bonham and Robert Plant from Led Zeppelin, you know, and then going into Napalm Death. There is something, you know, this city is an industrial city. It was built on manufacturing and foundries. And in the early 60s and 70s, in a fairly tough, desolate post-war world.
But you know what? That's really, really good analogy that you're making there, that the city was founded on iron forges and foundries, and in the white heat of that, the clanking of metal, the discordant sound, you get the horrendous thing, which is heavy metal. So that to me is a perfect thing. But even then, what we've not been able to do, even though we gave the world this incredibly influential genre of music, is then to really claim it as our own and to go to the world and to say, this is what has come out of Birmingham, in a way that a couple of indie, jangly indie pop bands in Manchester managed to, with the whole kind of Manchester thing, or the Mersey beat in the 60s. You know, why is it that nothing fashionable, nothing saleable in terms of youth culture, popular culture, can we actually brand as being part of Brum?
Okay, that's another deep question, and I'm going to go back again, as is my usual habit, and say, just go back to heavy metal and say, you know, while they were doing this and while they say this and while we understand this, it's much more complex. And this is, to me, this is the strength of the city, but also something we have to think about. While they were in those foundries and they were hearing that clanging, and they said that, you know, that's the only music we could make, they were working next to black Afro-Caribbean people. They were working next to Asian, Southeast Asian, predominantly Indian and Pakistani people. And those Asian and black people weren't coming out and making heavy metal music. They were coming out making Punjabi folk and then Bhangra or ska and reggae. So it's always much more complex than just saying, well, this is what happened and this is the sound that you make. And that, to me, is a great strength, because it shows the diversity within the city, and that's and the culture in the city, and how these people worked, lived, and played next door to each other, but created many different sounds. And we are the home of metal, and I think there are some people trying to do these things and make that claim. People like Capsule and their project Home of Metal. I think I would argue that you know, we are, if not more as important, you know, more important as London in terms of reggae and black music culture over extended period, going back to gospel, not just reggae, but gospel, ska. People like Joan Armour Trading, you know, people like Laura Mavula now, soul, jazz. And I think we are the centre of Bhangra music, you know, with people like Punjabi and, you know, the Qawwali sound. So there is this confluence of sounds, and I think that no other city can offer that.
Isn't that then, Jez, part of the problem? that we've actually done, we've actually given the world three diverse takes on popular music. So heavy metal, Bhangra, and Bhangra is always seems to be lost in the whole discussion. That, you know, we take this form of music from the Punjab, we give it a British spin, modernize it, throw it back at the world, and the Birmingham bit of it is completely and utterly lost. Yeah. That the crucible of this music is Brum. And then, as you rightly say, arguably, I might slightly disagree with you, because I think in terms of lovers rock in the late 70s, early 80s, you know, that's definitely a South London thing. So, and that's distinctively British. Distinctively London, sorry. But we did have a massive part to play in terms of British reggae, whether it's UB40, Steel Pulse, and then, you know, with the Beat and people like that, with, you know, with kind of ska. But it's three different genres of music. And with each genre, we've never been able to say made in Birmingham, put a stamp on it, and people going, I'll wear that hat.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that's a great source of frustration for me and for others, I think. And I think the city is slowly waking up to that. And realising its musical heritage plays a role in sort of social cohesion, because it tells a story of Birmingham. And as I say, you know, Bhangra is a great example. I mean, Bhangra, you know, if you, how it's been explained to me, it's Punjabi folk, as you've said. And then because they were living in areas like Handsworth or Sparkhill or Sparkbrook or Borstleigh, they'd live next to white and black neighbours, and they'd hear the bass lines of reggae and sound systems on one side, literally on one side of the house, and the other they'd hear white guitar bass music coming from the radio or the record player from their other neighbour, and they fused the white guitar lines with the bass of the reggae with their own Punjab. I mean, what story is that? I mean, you know, where else in the world are you going to get that, as I say, confluence of sound and this idea about living, working and playing together? And to me, it's incredible. And I think the city's slowly coming towards or coming round to thinking they need to give a bit more thought to music, and not just heritage, but the contemporary music, because it tells a story of the city. And it also brings in investment. You know, there's a report in Liverpool that Beatles tourism net brings in £90 million to the city a year and sustains 3,000 equivalent full-time jobs. And that's just the Beatles. And I know perhaps we haven't got a Beatles, but that's one band who brings in that. And there's an absolute slice of that you can take for Birmingham, because people will travel to come and stand in the place where Black Sabbath had their early gigs, or where Duran Duran formed and played the gigs, or where Steel Pulse first started out. You know, Steel Pulse, the only reggae band, I'm not sure if they still are, who to play the White House. They played Bill Clinton's, you know, inaugural prize, you know, Grammy Award winner, UB40, a really multicultural band. You know, so you've got all the, and this is just the tip of the iceberg, you know, you've got a recording studio in Handsworth again, Perry Bar, where, you know, John Bonham was ever first recorded, and Noddy Holder was first ever recorded, where the Thunderbirds sounds and special effects were made, a bit like the BBC's radiophonic studios, but in Birmingham, with a woman, Joan Taylor, and her husband John making up these sounds. So there's this plethora of stories that I think we should bring together and tell a more holistic approach to the city. And I think you mentioned something just a little minute ago. There is this sense, I think, of coolness. You know, we haven't had perhaps an Oasis or a Smiths or a Joy Division, you know, which, to be frank, are white monocultural music, indie guitar based music, which I love and I grew up with. But, you know, is there something there in terms of the representation and media about how these things are always given significance and importance over others, you know, and this sense of, like you say, coolness. And I think that's a problem that we've had and we continue to have. And that is I've got no clear answer for you here, but it's a very difficult thing to try and challenge and change perception. But I'm trying to do that, as are others.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
When you look at the kind of the great musical cities of the world, whether it's, let's say, New Orleans or New York, or even let's go to a city which is kind of not really heralded as being a great musical city. Let's say Chicago. You know, I love house music.
Yeah.
All what all of these places have in common is a diverse population. And I know I've just dealt with US cities there.
Yeah.
But there are going to be many others around the world. I say Cape Town in South Africa is a great musical city. With Birmingham's great diverse population, why have we not been able to sell the world on the multifaceted face of the city of Birmingham?
I think because no one's tried. I think, you know, if you speak to the guys in UB40 or you listen to Duran Duran or Steel Pulse, they'll always talk about Birmingham, come from Birmingham, and they're quite proud of it. You know, half of them don't live in the city anymore, which is always a problem. But I think I think the musicians themselves have a great store in the city and how it helped shape and form them. But we haven't. I think there's a more general question. I think particularly in the UK, we've never really grasped our music history and heritage. You know, we're very proud of it and we talk about it and how it's, you know, shaped the world. But we have, you know, there's the British music experience up in Liverpool and the Beatles and the Cavern stuff. But we've never really sort of seen it as a cultural entity. And what I'm trying to do is move away from this sense of important bands and say, well, you know, I'm interested in music culture. Now, of course, within music culture, the musicians and the bands themselves are central to it, but it's also the spaces and the places, you know, the venues that we go to. It's also the record shops. It's also the promoters and the managers and the press. And so I'm interested in the audience, the people who consume it. Music is important as a cultural asset rather than just an economic. And I think popular music is seen in this country as some sort of economic, ephemeral type activity. And I'm trying to, me and others are trying to make this argument, say, no, it's much deeper than that. It goes to the root of who we are and our identities. And I think Americans do that, maybe because, you know, we are, don't think, forget Roy Fiddy, in terms of popular music, we are fighting against thousands of years of history. And so this idea that popular music is somehow important historically when compared to King Edward or, you know, the Great Wars or the British Empire or whatever it might be. It's quite a difficult thing to argue. More and more people start to study this and understand that popular culture and popular music are actually worthy of historical research and historical discovery. And I'm hopeful that that will be the case again in Birmingham. And I think New Orleans, Cape Town, Melbourne and Sydney are doing it over in Australia. I'm starting to realise that actually, you know, people are interested in these sorts of things. Cities need to tell a more pluralistic history and stories about themselves. And what's the best way to do that? Well, through their music. And I think in Birmingham, I think we could lead the country. I know I keep talking about Liverpool, but Liverpool's hung up on really the Beatles, much to the annoyance, I think, of other acts who come from there. I'm sure people in Liverpool would disagree, or people who do these things in Liverpool would disagree. But same as Manchester, you've got a period of, you know, from 1978 to 1990 or 2000, from, you know, Joy Division through to Oasis, and that seems to be their history. As I said, Birmingham's got a history of 50, 60 years, going back to people like Andy Hamilton, who came off the Windrush. So there's a real interesting story to tell, and how we tell it and how we share that with the world could be groundbreaking. But we do need the people who have some influence in the city to understand that. And slowly, slowly, they are starting to do that, I think.
Why did you fall in love with Birmingham? Because you're not just somebody who just knows some stuff about Brum, but you're obviously in love with the city that you live in. When did it start?
I'm 48 now, so 50 next year, 49 this year, 50. And I suppose as you get older, you just have more experience. I mean, I've been lucky to travel. You know, I lived out of the country for a year and a half, and I've managed to travel the world a lot. And as I say, as you sort of get a bit reminiscent, you look back to youth and you recall the great times you had. You know, all the bands I'd seen, the bands I sort of grew up with in terms of friends being in bands. You know, and how music, particularly music, had shaped me, but also how the city had changed. And you know, as we've been talking, my annoyance as a girl, my annoyance of going away, places, and people saying, Birmingham, where's that? Or taking the mickey out of their language. And me thinking, well, I know more about this city. That a lot goes on, and I know that, you know, from cinema, you know, creating celluloid to the first Odeon cinemas, writers, the surrealist movement, people like Burne Jones and the great series art, pre-Raphaelite art. So I knew as I was getting older, it was just much more than what I was being shown on TV or reading in the press. And what really, I think, you know, if you ask me to speak, I think what really started to pinpoint the things that I do and why I became more and more passionate about it is I remember reading a map of, it was in one of the Observer's weekly music thing when they did a music paper on a Sunday, and they did a music map of the country about bands from it, and they put Dexys Midnight Runners up in Manchester or something stupid, and it, you know, way more than it should, it just really annoyed me. And from that moment I thought, right, I'm going to do something about this. I'm just really frustrated at continually hearing negative stories or reading negative things about the concrete city, about the stupid accent, about how nothing ever happens, about crime, because that wasn't the city that was reflected to me or the things that I was doing. You know, and it is, you know, there are crap parts of the city that, you know, without doubt, you know, there's things that are, I don't mean areas. But there's creativity and culture in anywhere that you go. Nietzsche's is not my area, so I don't know. But, you know, Nietzsche's has got the schools like the Holt and Duddeston Manor, you know, that where loads of black musical youth, but football players and other musicians came out, you know, got some great food places. So, you know, there's culture and creativity everywhere, but we're never told about that. And if you're not told about it and you grow up in Nietzsche's or Lazelle's, you are told that you don't amount to anything. My equivalent was Chelmsley Wood, which is now in Solihull, but my family grew up in Chelmsley Wood, and I spent a lot of time there. And we were always told, you know, you're white trash, you're never going to achieve anything. And you keep telling people that, they ain't going to achieve anything, and they're not going to respect their environment. And the reality is that my people in Chelmsley Wood went off to be head teachers in schools and lawyers and solicitors, record producers, record store holders, and they did all this fabulous stuff. Same in Nietzsche's, there'll be people in Nietzsche's themselves who were continually told, you're worthless, you're not going to do anything. And actually, they do things, and that's what I love about this city. This isn't true of every city as well, it's not a special thing, but in my city, this city, I know that people from those areas where they're told they are worthless are some of the most creative, clever, innovative, forward-thinking people, right? And they go off and do great things, whether it's in business, in culture, in arts, in science. And we're just not told. And this is a rambling answer to your question, but this is what keeps driving me. Music is my thing, but actually more broadly, that I know that there are amazing people in this city who are doing amazing things. There are amazing places. And we should be telling more people about it, because it is really worthwhile coming, and we are something, and we are interesting, and we are creative, and we are innovative, and we are forward thinking.
Is there a job waiting for you to be head of the City of Birmingham PR?
No, there is not. No, I'm not. I'm not that well versed, and I wouldn't want it, because I think you get forced, and I think this is part of the problem that, you know. Be careful what I say, but you know, with those marketing things, you're forced to look at the big things, you know, things like Cadbury's or shopping centres or whatever, and they're really important, but you know, they're only part of the story. So I'm much happier being on the outside, sort of nudging and pushing and promoting the real little bits of culture, the little bits about Birmingham that are really important that no one knows about, that we should be telling. And I think there's a much richer story to be told that way. If I was head of PR for Birmingham, I think I'd probably just be swallowed up with all the meetings and the bullshit that goes on with that.
Tell me how we're going to make this change in the perception of the UK's most exciting city. Because I'm telling you, Jez, right, as someone who travels outside of Brum, right, when I say Birmingham to people, they still sneer. Mm. Well, sneer is maybe somewhat overstating it, but they do have a little bit of a titter. In a way that if I said I was from Manchester, they never would.
And you know, the reality is they haven't been to Birmingham, I imagine. And it's a great shame, because I think the accent, I think you're right. I think there's a bit, we are a class-based country, and the Birmingham accent, and you know, probably the black country is a little bit below us, and then Birmingham has always been sneered at and has been considered stupid. And someone mentioned the other day, actually, I need to look into this, you know, that the way that we finish our words are in a different key. And that might be the reason why our accents are sort of derided upon or derided. I think, you know, I get great delight when people come who haven't been to the city come and go, oh my God, I didn't know this was there or that happened, or, you know, this city is such a great city. And it is, you come to the city and you don't know it and you introduce it. It's amazing. You have to work a little bit harder to find things out, but it is a great city that does great things and people genuinely love it when they come. I wouldn't say a once in a lifetime, but we have a golden opportunity to tell the world a completely different story about the city, and that's the Commonwealth Games in 2022. And I can't think of a more apt setting than Birmingham, because this city is built upon people from the Commonwealth, and I include, you know, white working class people in that. And I'm now challenging some of those cultural organisations and the and media organisations. Well, what story or stories are we going to tell? Are we going to keep telling them about retail and shopping and food, or are we going to tell them, actually, look at the things that we've made and created? Look, particularly for me, look at our music heritage. Look at, you know, what other city would produce or could produce a band like UB40, who are sneered at. I get that. You know, people think they're you know, light reggae, but you know what? They've sold 140 million albums. They get revered. They get the full treatment when they go to places like Hawaii and New Zealand from the Maoris and the indigenous people for the work that they do. Like I say, they've sold 140 million albums. Their first two albums are actually some of the greatest reggae albums ever made. And they're a completely multicultural group of working class people, Yemeni, Afro-Caribbean, white. You know, they're amazing. So how can we show these things? When 1.5 million people are going to come into the city, they estimate 2 billion people are going to watch the games on TV. What stories can we tell them? How can we give them a different view about Birmingham through its music? And for me, and other people would argue differently, but for me, music is the gateway, the door to telling the story of this city.
Jez, you're very good at this, aren't you? Right, you expound the virtues of Birmingham. You're incredibly passionate about music. You preempt where I'm going to move the conversation. You say, Royfield, I know where you're going to take this. Let's take this straight to UB40, probably Birmingham's most influential and culturally significant band. And they have resonance all over the world. So on this show, I always say to my guests that you need to pick one piece of music. And you've picked an epic, an opus. From UB40. Mm-hmm. Tell us what you're picking. Okay.
Well, I could strangle you if you were in front of me. Ask me to pick one record, almost impossible. So I conjugated and messed around, and I just couldn't choose. And then I thought, okay, well, what tells the story of Birmingham? And as I've just sort of said, for me, UB40 are a great example of that. They were a 12-piece band that people from all over the world have heritage from all over the world, who came together in a Borstal Heath, you know, were imbued with reggae, love reggae, and have sold 140 million albums, who are play all over the world, play to 50, 60,000 people, but are yet sneered at, you know, in the press. They're somehow, you know, they're not reggae, they're not cool. But, you know, they bring a lot of joy to a lot of people, and that is what music is about. This particular track goes back to their very first album, Signing Off, which is, for me, as I say, one of the greatest political reggae albums. And it's this particular song, Madame Medusa, shows, I think, the band's strength and power. It's a 12-minute track, but it's all about Margaret Thatcher. And they, what UB40 did, even by their very name at that time, they turned a spotlight on political things. And it always amazed me. I didn't know at the time, as I grew older, the first track on the album is a song called Tyler. And it was about a black guy in America who wrongly imprisoned for a murder. And I was thinking, how on earth are these 18, 19-year-old guys, this is the days before the internet and before, you know, finding out information, how would these blokes from Borstal Heath, these kids from Borstal Heath, know about some black guy in America in some godforsaken town in the south, being, you know, put in jail, and then making a song about it and asking for his freedom. It blows my mind. It still blows. When I talk about it now, I'm still thinking, oh my God, how on earth? So I almost chose that song. But I thought this was a very particular song about the United Kingdom at a particular time when Thatcher was destroying our communities right across the country, but Birmingham really suffered. And above everything else, it's just a fantastic song.
right, but hey, she gone off her head and got to shoot her dead. Run for your life before she eat you alive. Move off away, cause you're blocking on the day. Say, move off away, cause you're blocking on the day. Run for your life before she eat you alive. Say, she gone off her head and got to shoot her dead.
It's 12 minutes long.
Yeah.
All right. Is it, in effect, UB40's Bohemian Rhapsody, but, like, times two?
Wow. Okay. I've never thought about that, but yeah, absolutely. I mean, we very rarely listen to long pieces of music now. I mean, of course, they were a reggae band, so they did a lot of dub, you know, and they had Present Arms in Dub was a great album. So they were used to exploring the spaces within music, but they had to pick this up from their black friends and bands. I mean, at that time in Birmingham, you know, Steel Pulse were probably the big band coming through. But you had bands like Bashara and Eclipse and Unity and African Star, and I've probably missed loads of others. There was loads of, you know, reggae in the city, and UB40 were experimenting. And I think if you talk to Brian, they were saying, you know, at that time they were rough and ready and quite raw, and it's that rawness. So it could well be their Bohemian Rhapsody, but I mean, I love Bohemian Rhapsody, but this song is both political, but you can dance to it. And if it's so required, you can take illicit substances, and you could imagine this in a club, in a blues house, in a blues party in Balsall Heath in 1980, just blaring out the. And UB40, I don't know if you agree with this, but in 1980, 81, 82, all you would hear in Birmingham, particularly during summer, whether people having barbecues or the windows were open during the heat, you'd hear UB40 coming out. And if we made films like they made films in New York, that they would be the soundtrack to those films. You know, they'd be the background music as people are walking around doing the business or driving up and down the streets. It would be UB40, and that's why I love this band. That's why they're so important to Birmingham, and that's why I particularly like this song, because you can sit and listen to it. You can imagine it in a blues club. You can imagine, you know, proper hardcore reggae dudes dropping this track in the Shebeens and the blues around Birmingham. And so, yeah, perhaps it is Birmingham's Bohemian Rhapsody times two.
UB40 obviously got their break by playing small music venues in and around, whether it was, you know, the city centre back then in the 1980s. Where are the good small music venues now that new bands can actually go out and play in front of an appreciative audience?
Well, this is a hot topic at the moment in Birmingham and across the country. You know, we're losing lots and lots of small places and venues. The Flapper is just about to close, which has been going for 50 years. Presumably it's a live music venue for 25 years, but bands like The Editors sort of started there.
Where is The Flapper, Jess?
So The Flapper is, if you know Birmingham at all, it's behind the Genting Arena, which is the National Indoor Arena on the canals. Mm-hmm. And there's a block of floor, it's right in the city centre. On the canals by four blocks of flats. It's been there for, it used to be called the Longboat, then the Flapper and Firkin, and now the Firkin. The Rainbow in Digbeth, which is the sort of cultural creative quarter of the city. The Rainbow is closed. Their license was revoked a couple of months or so ago, but we're hopeful that might come back. Someone else might take that on. We lost the Jug of Ale, where Oasis played to 15 people. We've lost Golden. So we've lost lots and lots of venues through numerous reasons, mainly through developers wanting to build more and more flats. But we do have some great venues. We've got things like the Institute in Digbeth and the Sunflower Lounge for small indie-type bands. We've got things like Lab 11 in Digbeth and the Rooftop and Mezzanine in Digbeth. We've got the Hare and Hounds, which is still going strong. It was actually the first place that UB40 played in 1980. But there is an issue around, you know, the venues I've said there predominantly play, you know, safe music. I can't think of the word. I don't want to say black music or urban music. But there has been an issue, and I'm sure you're aware of this, for a number of years about how we're you know, black youth can go and experience music because of the laws placed on promoters who promote urban nights, for want of a better term. You know, they face a lot of pressure and hassle from the police, and they're often closed down. So there is that sense of venues are closing down because of redevelopment and the end of their life cycle. New ones are coming up, but there is still this sort of elephant in the room about, well, you know, where do black progressively more Asian youth, where do they go and find and listen to new music? Because it's very difficult, or the police make it very difficult for those promoters to put live music on. So we have still got that problem in Birmingham. But there are, you know, we have a good range of venues, but we could always do with more, I think. And there is a sense that we lack a couple of sort of mid-sized venues, the sort of 400, 800 to 1,000. Because you need those things, as you mentioned, to progress. You need to start and cut your teeth at those very small ones where they all need to write in your face, and you need them to progress and develop and go through the stages of that. So it's healthy, but it could be much better.
So where does the Crown Pub come into this whole kind of campaign to keep Brum music alive and vibrant?
Well, the Crown campaign is something I've been working on for a while, and the Crown, if people don't know it, is when the New Street Station has been redeveloped, so you can they basically made a walkway from the south to the north of the city centre, and you come out through the south side of the entrance, and there's a beautiful pub on the corner of Hill Street and Station Street. It curves around the corner. It's two doors away from the Electric Cinema, which is the oldest working cinema in the country. It's about three doors, which is about another three doors down from the Repertory, the old Rep Theatre, which is the oldest purpose-built theatre in the country. So it's on this historically important street. And the building itself has had a 40-year association with live music. It was the site of Ian Campbell, who's the father of Robin, Duncan and Ali from UB40. There's some heritage there. He had a folk group there, and he recorded the first ever live folk album called Kale at the Crown in 1964. It became then something called Henry's Blues House, and it's where Black Sabbath had their first ever gigs, and where blues musicians like Sonny Boy Williamson, Jabby Jack Dupree would play, and where Tony Iommi and Ozzy Osbourne and Robert Page, Christy McVeigh from Fleetwood Mac, she was from Birmingham, they'd go and listen to these blues musicians, and they incorporate what they were hearing and seeing into their music. And then they'd go and play there. As I say, Sabbath had their early gigs. Then in the 70s, it became a home of the punks. It's where Rankin Roger from The Beat worked behind the bar, and where The Beat sort of started off very early days. It's where GBH, who are still gigging, started out. It's where the punks and the skins met. It's where John Taylor from Duran Duran had a residency in 1978 and said, you know, it's really important. That's where I learned. And then it sort of went into a little bit of disrepair and then became, a few years later, the centre of punks again. So this had this 40-year period of music association. And arguably, I would argue that it's actually internationally important, particularly around the Sabbath connection. And that if it was in any other city, or particularly in America, it would be a museum and a tourist attraction. You know, you can actually still go and stand on the stage where the four original founding members of Black Sabbath, who we say created and invented heavy metal, played their first gigs. It is the cavern to heavy metal aficionados, but it's also got a much deeper history. So it's been closed for years, 3 years. It's been bought by a company in Japan who want to build a hotel on it, and I've just stuck my head above the window in the last few weeks and said, well, actually, look, it's still closed. We've got the Commonwealth Games coming up. Why can't we think about using this beautiful building, which is 130 years old, historically beautiful building, as a music hub, as a bar, restaurant downstairs, as a music museum upstairs, and you can have a heavy metal or Black Sabbath boutique hotel upstairs. So for me, there's an opportunity to create a really famous, fabulous visitor tourist attraction for the city that celebrates its music heritage. This would be the perfect location. It is internationally important, and it would have people from around the world travelling to come and see it and to visit it and to stand on that stage where all these amazing musicians first started out and played. And I'm just trying to see if we can get something done. It's very difficult. A Japanese organisation owns it. They're quite reticent to tell us what their plans are or to connect with us. I don't think I've got much chance of doing it, but it kickstarts that conversation. It kickstarts it and says, okay, if we can't have that, well, what else are we going to do? Where else can we do it? Should we be doing it? And it's making a few people sort of sit up and think, oh, okay, actually, perhaps we should be taking this more seriously. You know, in the Midlands last year, I think live music contributed £231 million to the local economy and supported 2,200 jobs. Now, that's not heritage, but, you know, it's they class it as music tourism. And so I'm trying to make these arguments to people like Andy Street, the mayor of West Midlands, to the city council, and saying this is not just some sort of, you know, whim or nice nostalgic thing. It's actually, there's actually economic benefits in you supporting, underpinning, understanding, putting infrastructure in to music activities in the city, both historical and contemporary. And, you know, there is a return for the city. It brings in a lot of money, and we're only scratching the surface. I think we could double, maybe even treble that over a period of time. If we give it some thought and think about it, and we invest a lot of money into the arts, into film and dance is a big one now. Well, why don't we do it to music, all music?
You talked about the return that music can give the city, but the city of Birmingham is definitely returning as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
But if there is one thing which, let's say, the city elders should do, other than music, other than getting behind music to help promote the city, what should it be? And then there's one thing that Brummies should do to extol the virtues of the city as well. What should they do, and what should it be?
Wow. Okay. I think, so looking at the city agencies, for want of a better word, and you've mentioned earlier about branding, they're fixated on having a branding or marketing slogan or something, and they're struggling for it. And it seems to me, and they're always saying, well, what is the one thing? What is the one thing? And, you know, if we're truthful about the city, there isn't one thing, and we should move away from trying to have this one, story. Our motto is a city of 1,000 trades, and a friend said to me, and I've been thinking about this, we should be a city of 1,000 voices as well, because we have, I think there's 190 languages spoken in this city, which is incredible, and we shouldn't think about the city in its one voice. We have a plurality of voices and stories and narratives and histories, and it's beyond me, but I would argue that that's what we need to, that's our greatest strength. We talk about diversity, that it's our greatest thing that we've given the world, I think, the way that we live and work and play next door to each other. And it would be to try and encompass that and say, okay, well, how are we a city of 1,000 voices? How do we communicate that to people to take to understand what the city's about? For Brummies, I mean, I don't know. I think I'm not sure if I change anything. I think I think we are a very self.
I think the whole thing about the geographic location of Birmingham is actually really important and central to our lack of distinct identity. But it's not just the country looking at us and saying, but where exactly is it? What exactly are they? It's also us in and of itself. Mm. I love football. And it's, for me, quite marked that if you were to start from Hadrian's Wall and go to every city, progressively going further and further south, those cities, those towns are one club towns. In terms of support. So when in Newcastle, no one supports Manchester United in Newcastle. Ditto Sunderland. Ditto Leeds, right? The first major UK city you can get to where there is a confusion about civic pride is actually Birmingham. I.e., you will see born and bred Brummies that support Liverpool, Manchester United, as well as Aston Villa and Birmingham City. You know, arguably, it's not even that way in Leicester, somewhere like Leicester, or definitely not in Derby. Everyone in Derby supports Derby County. However, if you then pass Birmingham and go further south, then this lack of local civic identity, pride, which is manifest through your supporting your local football team, is writ large. So in somewhere like, I don't know, Bristol, they're all over the place. But that change happens in Birmingham. And I think us Brummies, in and of ourselves, there is something about it. We are not, and maybe it's part of the secret sauce of Birmingham, this whole 1,000 voices, a city of 1,000 trades. But Mancunians are like, I am from Manchester, in a way that Brummies, we don't extol our civic identity in the same way.
That's true. I've got an answer. I think, there's a sense, again, we're a city that's welcomed people from all around the world, and perhaps our civic pride is diluted through that, but makes it stronger. I think, you know, you get told enough times that your accent's crap and you're crap, and, you know, there's an element of that. There's also a sense, and you can't really, I don't know how you sort of bottle this, but there's a sense that, yeah, well, you know, Manchester or Liverpool carry on and talk the talk, but we got on and do things. And, you know, we don't need that that validation of the things that we do. We're quite happy in our history and in the way we go forward and the things that we do. And, you know, if you want to join us, join us. If you don't, and we don't really care about it.
But, Jez, is that really true? Because the other sense that I get from Brum is that our development in the last, I don't know, let's say 50 or 60 years since the massive debacle of the concrete collars and the 60s and early 70s redevelopment, is that we are quite happy to have our decisions made upon high for us. That considering there is this radical history to the city, and, you know, Joseph Chamberlain could go and create Corporation Street and put gas lights everywhere. And then previous to that, before the 1832 Reform Act, you know, there were 200,000 people talking on listening to speech on Newall Hill. You know, Birmingham has this really proud, radical history. But actually, we're kind of top down when it comes to solutions. And I actually think what the City Council needs to do is to create an environment whereby those 1,000 trades can actually flourish. So we've got to stop thinking of big developments all over the place, but and actually create spaces so that whether it's young people, entrepreneurs, can actually come in and colonise bits of the city centre on the periphery and make them unique and distinct, you know, and we've actually got to take that control back into our hands, as opposed to waiting for another multi-million billion pound scheme to float in from Dubai, China, wherever, knock down a few buildings, build a few more. That actually were a passive.
Well, no, I disagree. I think okay, let's go to the City Council first. I think, you know, there's a lack of understanding in Birmingham and elsewhere of the actualities of the City Council itself. It is, I think it still is, the biggest municipal council in Europe. And with that, it becomes all the attendant problems. You know, so if we're talking about culture or civic pride, well, they're important, and I'd always defend them. But when you were trying to run something that had 1,550,000 employees, that had to house, you know, 500,000 people, is responsible for the environment, for the police, for the education, for social services, elements of the health, transport. You know, it's by far the biggest local authority in this country, and as I say, it was, maybe still is in Europe. So if you go to London, London has a lot of devolved boroughs, and they have a say over what goes on, you know, through financials and decision making. Manchester is almost a quarter of the size of them, both geographically and in city council. So I have some, you know, I started working in the City Council. That's one of my first working life in the City Council. I have some sympathy for the City Council and having to, you know, the huge, huge problems that it has in terms of trying to manage all these things, and things get lost. So I understand that. I also think that, you know, I don't think we are a passive, but I think, you know, as I said before, people in Birmingham, in my experience, just get on and do things. Right, and I don't. Manchester, you know, again, let's use Manchester. Let's Liverpool or Newcastle or any other city. You know, we are becoming more and more homogenised, and it's more and more, you know, around capitalism. You know, so it doesn't matter. You know, you speak to people in Manchester now, and they'll tell you that actually all our spaces and places are disappearing, and it's just becoming what we're losing our identity. Or you talk to people in Liverpool, that massive redevelopment of one. It's called Liverpool One by the docks. It's a massive shopping centre. We're losing our public spaces, and we're losing our public realm, and we're losing the spaces and places where culture and creativity can take place. And people are finding it elsewhere, but they're being dispersed. And we're becoming one big, massive blob of sameness across this country. And it's a real issue. And Birmingham is absolutely no different from any other city in that respect. What I can't speak for what goes on in the other city, but what I do know in this city, that people are clinging on to this sense of being makers, creators, innovators, and they are making and creating things, but they just don't particularly go and shout about it. They're just we do what we do, and who cares if anyone likes us? Now, people like me get frustrated at that, because I'm saying, well, actually, there's more that can be done. We can bring more people in, and you know, really, does it really matter if you know what someone in Alabama or New York thinks about Birmingham? Will it really change what goes on in Birmingham? I'd like the city and its people to be more forward-thinking and more proactive in the things they do and say, because it matters, I think, for generations. You know, for my kids, I want my kids to think, actually, I come from a city that does do and create things, and I can be like that. Look, there's that person over there. I want to be like that, and I want to emulate that. So that's where the history is important for me, rather than just some nostalgia trip. It's actually about knowing your history, understanding your history, and then emulating and creating your own history, and that's where cities can generate and regenerate. So I hear what you're saying. I don't fully agree with it. I agree with parts of it. But Birmingham, believe me, is no different to any other city in this country at the moment. There is just a massive building development. That money's flooding in from China, India, Dubai, the Gulf States. Manchester City, you know, bless them, you know, most of their stuff now is built on money from Qatar, which is an awful state. No one blinks an eyelid in Manchester. They don't care. You know, they're being successful. But actually, the roots of their money is disgraceful. It's awful. You know, but it brings cachet and kudos to the city, and they'll milk it for its worth.
Jez Collins, thank you for coming on to Friday to extol the virtues of our hometown, the city that we love, Birmingham. And you know what?
And it is the greatest city. Without doubt.
Bishara were a reggae band from Moseley in Birmingham, and they were formed in 1976. The band are most notable for their 1981 Love of Rock hit, Men Cry Too. Whoa, whoa, whoa.
Possibly even get on the show, you can do that by emailing me at royfield@gmail.com. You can find me on Twitter. I'm not great on the platform, but I am at Royfield on Twitter. And of course, you can go all the way over to Facebook and you can find Friday 15 there. Oh, one last thing. Be awesome if you could write us a little bit of a review on iTunes or on a podcatcher of your choice. See you all again in 7 days' time. On another Friday.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues. your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.